This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
When there's a smile in your heart, there's no better time to start.
Think of all the joy you'll find when you leave the world behind.
And bid your cares goodbye. You can fly, you can fly, you can fly, you can fly, you can fly.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, and this is You Can Fly from Disney's 1953 adaptation of Peter Pan. This week on Outtakes, we're celebrating Peter Pan and the very queer filmic legacy of the boy who wouldn't grow up. Our guest is Alison Cavey, co-author and editor of Second Star to the Right, and we are exploring gender and sexuality in this myth of the innocence of youth. You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
You bitch!
No idea how bad it gets.
Sally, I think I'll buy the flowers myself.
But you're not a girl, you're a guy. And why would a guy want to marry a guy?
Don't stomp your little lassies and brother she's a me, honey.
John Calliope, will you go around with me?
Don't fuck with me, fellas!
Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty. I can't stand it anymore.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
Is butter a crumb?
I had a hunch you might be a real romantic.
We were decoys. He used us as bait. We procured for him.
We could have had a good life together. Fucking real good life. But you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now is Brokeback Mountain.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we are celebrating the filmic legacy of Peter Pan and the boy who could not grow up.
Well, why did you look at Alan when you said that, Daniel?
Alan is
your boyish charms. That's kind of the tie you're wearing is very schoolboy tonight.
It is, isn't it? You know, very, very private schoolboy, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I like it.
But yes, we're going to have fun with basically a story that has enchanted children and adults for about a century. Actually, we're going to darken this story up, aren't we?
Well, Peter Pan was first brought into the world, shall we say, 1902, when J.M. Barrie gave us The Little White Bird, which was actually not a book about Peter Pan. It was a book about, it was really semi kind of autobiographical, but it was about his kind of longing for this child. And there's a kind of sinister twist, really, because he uses Peter Pan to entice the child, the story of Peter Pan, to entice the child in that book. And then in 1904, he gives us Peter Pan. So this is when he takes the character that he developed in The Little White Bird and puts it into this play, which captured the imagination of the world, really. Mm. We now have over 200 films inspired by this one play. Of course, there were other texts that followed. So we got Peter and Wendy in 1911. And between that, there was Peter Pan in Kensington Gardens. Mm-hmm. So Barrie wrote a lot about Peter Pan and did a lot to develop the mythology. But what we've seen since then is that mythology has given rise to a kind of filmic tradition. And the filmic tradition has kind of taken the story and, as it is apt to do, kind of reinvented it for the new ages. Mm-hmm. And now what we have is a kind of mythology that's closely resembles the story J.M. Barrie told, but has a lot of differences as well.
Sorry.
I'm looking at you, Alan.
God, we've been away for so long. We've been away for 5 weeks and just a little bit out of practice.
Speak for yourself.
Hey, you fluffed up your lines earlier on too, Daniel, but I think... But I think what we see in these film adaptations, we actually don't get to see the origins of Peter Pan. They're not explained in the film.
No.
Whereas in the play and the books, they do. They actually really explain Peter Pan's backstory. So,
well, that's
in the films that we're going to be covering tonight, we actually really don't get to see his backstory. We really get to see him when he first meets the Darlings for the first time, when he's in search of his lost shadow.
Right. So it's in The Little White Bird that the origin of Peter Pan is really explored. I mean, he hears his parents talking about the fact that he's going to grow up, and he decides to leave. And then he tries to come home shortly after and finds the window barred and another boy in his place. It's this kind of tragic and heart-wrenching tale. And then he flies off to Neverland, where he's met by or kind of leads the lost boys, who are... boys who have fallen out of the prams of their nurses in Kensington Gardens.
How sad. How are you laughing at that, Alan?
It's ludicrous, isn't it?
It is.
What it is is tragic because, as the scholarship shows, what we're dealing with here is a land... I mean, these are people who don't grow up. And if you think about people who don't grow up, they're usually, I hate to say it, dead. I mean, what we're dealing with here are spirits. We're dealing with kind of otherworldly souls of children who, you know, have lost their parents.
Well, that's a really interesting take on that, Daniel. I did not sort of go along those lines of thinking that potentially the Lost Boys and Peter Pan are really spirits from another realm.
Unless you're watching the horror Lost Boys and it's vampires. Yeah,
that's right.
But the vampire mythology...
Again, it's the same thing. They never grow up. They never grow old. They never die.
But it's really... Because we know that vampires are used in queer cinema, often as a metaphor for HIV/AIDS. There's a legacy built out of the way that vampires are used in terms of kind of transmission of blood and things like that. The imagery is very resonant of and has been used to kind of capture the spirit of HIV/AIDS. And so if we lay that on top of Peter Pan, which deals with death, which deals with immortality, which deals with mortality and innocence and the kind of want not to grow up, because, you know, Peter Pan really does explore the trajectory that you're put on when you grow up. It does kind of take on a very sinister edge.
Now, was this, because we were talking about this earlier, was this a film that you both enjoyed growing up? It's not something I connected with.
Well, we're talking about a number of films.
Yeah, but the original ones, when we think of the Disney 1953 one, was this something, that's something all of us have seen in some iteration?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that the magic of Disney...
And the myth was, of the original innocent.
The magic of Disney is that he does sort of sugarcoat it. And so you see the Disney-ized version of Peter Pan. And of course, who wouldn't love a flying boy?
It didn't impress
and
a young lesbian.
Tinkerbell, a fairy, you know, as your sidekick. I mean, hello. Look, these are great things for kids.
It's clear... Look, Peter Pan, Disney has this kind of magical touch that when it touches a story, it cements it into culture as a cornerstone of our culture. I think it did that with Peter Pan.
And it's almost the point of reference. It becomes the point of reference that everything else is compared to.
And it does for so many fairy
tales. That's right,
But I have to say... As much a fan as I am of Peter Pan, and as much a fan as I am of Disney, I don't love this film.
Daniel,
I want to make the case tonight. We are going to be exploring gender and sexuality in Peter Pan. I want to make the case that it's Disney's 1953 version of Peter Pan that really sexualizes the story.
Oh, I think that's a long bow to draw.
We were talking about The Little White Bird before. In that story, Peter Pan is about 3 or 4 days old.
Yes, baby.
And you know, until Disney's Peter Pan, in any filming adaptation, in any stage adaptation, Peter Pan was always played by a woman. And then for the first time in Disney's 1953 version of the film...
In Technicolor.
We have Bobby Driscoll, who was a teen heartthrob at the time, a boy no less, playing a boy. And rather than focusing on the relationship between Peter and Wendy, what we get is a slightly homoerotic relationship between Peter and Hook. I realize that.
I see. What was that long bow again?
Yeah, that's another one.
No,
that's
no, two no. Wait, now. Wait. We've talked a lot about homosociality on this program.
Oh, yes. I knew it was coming.
The woman is used as a conduit for the sexual tension between the male characters. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What we see in Disney is because, you know, if there is any sexuality in the original story, it's the relationship between Wendy and Peter, and indeed Wendy's mother and Peter, and ultimately Wendy's daughter and Peter, mm-hmm. and this idea that they all reserve a kiss for Peter, which later an acorn stands in as. But the point is that in Disney's film, we start to see the relationship between Hook and Pan take prevalence over the relationship of Wendy and Pan, and that is a tradition that is pushed further and explored further in films which subsequently followed.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
I realise it sounds
I'm giving you that now. Okay, now that you explained yourself.
We'll
very long-winded explanation on my day, but keep going.
We'll explore it later, but I'm conscious of the fact that we actually haven't been in the studio together for a month. It's been a long time, mm-hmm. Which is why we're a little bit rusty. But
speak for yourself,
love. Bit of dead air there for a minute, but that's okay.
It also means that there's a lot that's happened in the month that we haven't been on air. So to kick off the show tonight, before we speak with Alison, our guest later, about gender and sexuality in Peter Pan.
And destroy the myth, yes.
Destroy the myth. we do want to revisit one of our favourite segments here on Outtakes, which is the Outtakes, Weekly Outtakes.
To LA first, where the 29th annual GLAAD Media Awards have taken place. Call Me By Your Name received the night's top award as the year's best wide release film. Of course, Fantastic Woman took home the award for the year's best limited release film. Catch our podcast of our interviews with those directors and both films on joy.org.au/outtakes.
Love the promo there, Gina. And in other award news, RuPaul's Drag Race and Love, Simon have been nominated for this year's MTV Movie and TV Awards. The hit coming of age, The hit coming of age book, Love, Simon, has been nominated in the Best Kiss category. But the film faces tough odds. It's up against kisses from Riverdale, Jane the Virgin, Stranger Things and Ready Player One, which notably features a gender non-binary character in a lead role.
You made it through, Alan.
I did.
Bianca Del Rio is back with Hurricane Bianca from Russia with Hate. The film stars a slew of familiar faces, including Katja, Shangela and Darian Lakes, plus stars like Wanda Sykes, Rachel Dratch and Cheyenne Jackson. No word yet on when or on what platform the film is scheduled to release here in Australia.
Now, Paramount Network has actually ordered 10 episodes of the TV reboot of the cult classic film First Wives Club. The show will be written by Girls' top co-writer Tracy Oliver, the executive producer behind the names of Devil Wears Prada and the original First Wives Club. Now, the original film from 1996 starred Diane Keaton, Bette Midler, Goldie Hawn as three New Yorkers who find sisterhood after the death of their marriages. So keen to see what's going to come out of that.
Yeah, me too.
And in other Broadway news, it's official. Moulin Rouge is headed to Broadway. Aaron Tveit, who starred in Les Miserables and Grease Live, has been cast as the doe-eyed bohemian who falls for Satine. His rendition of Come What May has been released online ahead of the show's opening in Boston this summer.
Yeah, I've heard it, but I prefer Ewan McGregor. And finally, Celine Dion has released her new single, Ashes, and it's a belter. The Canadian singer dropped the record as part of the official soundtrack to Deadpool 2, which is slated for release later this month. The song's music video features an unconventional exchange between the singer and Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool, with the My Heart Will Go On superstar telling the Marvel hero to beat it.
Well, you got through, Alan.
We got through.
And can I recommend people
very
watch...
Very wordy this time around, Daniel. You know?
Now, with that Celine Dion song, I mean, you know, Daniel, you are a major Celine Dion fan.
I am.
And I'm sure that song will be on high rotation here at Joy. But can I recommend people watch the film clip? In fact, you can forward the song if you're not a fan of Dion, Celine, and just watch the last, like, 10 seconds of that film clip because it's well worth
Shall we have a taste of it? This is Ashes from the Deadpool soundtrack. You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
I've been shaking, I've been bending backwards till I'm broke, watching all these dreams go up in smoke. Let beauty come out of ashes, let beauty come out.
For all voices, this is Joy.
Walt Disney Pictures invites you to fly away with Peter Pan. He's the boy who never grew up, taking you on an adventure you'll never forget. It's Tinkerbell and Tiger Lily, Captain Hook and Crocodile. It's Wendy, John and Michael, and action, adventure and fun. Only in theaters, it's the one summer movie you won't want to miss. It's Walt Disney's classic, Peter Pan.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we are celebrating Peter Pan and the filmic legacy that it has given rise to. That was the 1953, or it was a trailer for the 1953 Peter Pan film. The film's been re-released a number of times, and that was a trailer for its re-release in 1987.
Oh.
Been re-released a number of times. I think it's grossed something like, if you adjust the gross for inflation, about $400 million US dollars, which doesn't sound like a lot compared to a film like Avengers, which is on now, but is a substantial amount for a film of its budget.
Oh, for sure, without a doubt.
And it is. It is the kind of iconic representation of Peter Pan. Yeah. And for me, I think it's when the representation of Peter Pan in film started to change.
See, that's the thing. I remember this very innocently to the image of the Peter Pan story we were talking about outside. I find the 2003, the PJ Hogan one, far more sexualized in that sort of representation of the young.
And can I say it was the 2003 PJ Hogan version of Peter Pan. So PJ Hogan, our listeners may well know from Muriel's Wedding, amongst other great Australian works.
So he sold out and went to Hollywood, in other words.
Got to pay the bills. People got to eat.
I don't see this as a sellout. Mm-hmm. One, because it's an excellent film.
Great film.
And two, because it has the same kind of whimsy that I think he brings to his other work.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was going to say about this film is it was in this film that I kind of discovered my passion for Peter Pan. So this came out when I was about, I think 13 12. Or 14. Yeah, you weren't far off. It's a really magical film.
What if you could escape to a faraway world without parents?
Forget them, Wendy. Forget them all. Come away to Neverland.
Without any rules. Without anyone telling you what to do.
Come with me, we'll never, never have to worry about grown-up things again.
Never is an awfully long time.
So you can see we have this kind of Coldplay soundtrack in the background, and this kind of lingering whispering between Peter and Wendy, it is sexualized.
Because he's a cheeky, cockier kind of version of a Peter Pan that we've ever seen on air.
Well, and he's also
confidence.
And he's also prepubescent. I mean, he's on the verge of puberty. But that's, there's a nascent sexuality there anyway. And of course, they dress him. He's only half dressed.
Rather scantily clad.
Very scantily clad. I mean, it's a bit disturbing. And you also see, and there's also some, like, I guess.
That's
some,
a bulldog harness he's wearing.
But the film propelled him to kind of teenage heartthrob status.
Yeah.
And I think that in itself speaks to the kind of sexualization that this film was imbued with. I do see...
When compared to the 1953 version, I didn't see any sexualization in 1953.
I can't remember that either.
It's Disney, for Christ's sake. During the time of all the censorship, I cannot imagine this that is, would be any this, sexualization.
I realise it's hard for you to cast your mind back to your teenage years when the film came out.
What are you implying, Daniel?
But
I watched it again on the weekend. It is fresh in my memory.
But what I am suggesting is that I think... the kind of Bobby Driscoll played Peter Pan of 1953 was perhaps as sexual, if not more sexual, to the audiences of that time and the sensibilities of that time as the Jeremy Sumpter of 2003 was. It's exactly 53 years later.
Gotcha.
And interestingly enough, another film that we want to discuss tonight, Finding Neverland, directed by Mark Forster, whose films like Monsters Ball and Stay I just love. His film, Finding Neverland, was scheduled to come out in 2003.
But it's not actually a Peter Pan film per se. This is a biopic, really, of J.M. Barrie and his relationship with the Llewellyn Davies boys who inspired Peter Pan.
Correct. Mm. Yeah. Correct. It's very polite, shall we say, about how
very
it...
Very vanilla.
Which has a certain charm.
It does.
It's a tearjerker, this film.
It's the weeping. Oh, I was weeping, don't you worry.
It's Johnny Depp and Kate Winslet. Like, you know, it is very polite. It doesn't stay true to the history of the author.
Well, you see, so this is the thing. The story is published in the early 20th century, and over the past kind of century, really, a mythology has developed about the story and about the man behind the story and his relationship with the boys who inspired it. Now, I think it was... So there were four boys, George, Michael, Peter and...
There was John. And Nico. There was actually...
Well, there was five.
Not in Neverland. In real life, there was five. But in Finding Neverland, there was only four.
But did Nico die young?
No. Nico was the last one to die. He died in 1980.
It's actually really tragic when you start hearing the stories of these boys.
So this is it. There were... Well, I thought there were four of them. Apparently, there were five.
Five, yeah.
George, Michael, except John, for Peter, one, Nico. Died in really tragic circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah.
One was a victim of a gay love suicide pact.
Allegedly.
Well, this is most
all of this is.
Oh,
allegedly.
Listen, and they were both swimming in an area that was notorious for bad river currents and drownings.
Yeah.
So. But it was George who died in the battlefield in the First World War.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then was it Peter who killed himself
when he was 63 after
publishing
writing.
At the time?
Yeah.
At the time, he destroyed all of the letters between he and Barrie, reportedly, allegedly. Because he said they were quote unquote too much.
Mm-hmm.
And so there has been this mythology that's developed about, you know, the relationship that Barrie had with the boys to cause these kind of unfortunate circumstances. And indeed, there is a letter that Barrie sent to
Michael.
On his birthday about candles on his cake, which has been used to kind of back up this proposition that he had an unhealthy relationship. The letter runs, "I wish I could be with you and your candles. You can look on me as one of your candles, the one that burns badly, the greasy one that is bent in the middle. But still, hooray, I am Michael's candle. Dear Michael, I am very fond of you, but don't tell anyone."
It's the don't tell anyone that makes it a bit...
creepy from today's viewing.
From today.
We have to go back in time to the early Edwardian times and in the turn of the century.
Yeah, so I've read a few pieces on that letter, and it's the bent candle, and it's like, the don't tell anyone part is the part that really would that have changed that interpretation now, of don't tell someone?
Now again,
but where's the context? I mean, a lot of this stuff is just taken out of context.
That's the thing, though. So we have to be very clear about the fact that all of the boys in their time refuted any allegation that there was any improper relationship.
Barry became their legal guardian after both their parents passed away. So in Finding Neverland with Johnny Depp, the father's in that story, that telling of that story, the father's already deceased, and it's the mother who, you know, spoiler from 2004, dies.
Yeah.
And then he becomes custody. You know, he takes custody of the kids. But in the true story, both the father and mother were still alive when he entered their lives.
That's right. And they died about 3 years apart.
Yeah.
I think Alison Cavey, who is joining us later in the program and has written a lot about various aspects of Peter Pan, does make the point in her writing, like a number of other academics, that there really is no evidence to suggest that there was an improper relationship. Mm-hmm. And in fact, any evidence that there is suggests that there was not.
Yeah.
But I think why these kind of stories and gossip are interesting is because they kind of feed into this mythology. The thing about Peter Pan, the thing I think that's attracted so many people to the story, and indeed me to the story, is that it's so double-edged. At once, this is a story about youthful bliss and innocence and this kind of escapism. But on the other hand, there's this kind of underbelly of morbidity and, you know,
cruelty.
Peter Pan is a murderer. Let's call him out for what he is. He kills people for the fun of it.
Yep. And 1953, he's a racist murderer too.
Yeah.
But this is the thing about
childhood. Children are uninhibited in their emotions. You get the full spectrum. One minute they're angelic and then the next minute they're evil incarnate. And so this is what you see in children until they actually reach adulthood, and then they learn to moderate these emotions. And so I think this is what you really get to see in Peter Pan. He's actually showing you the light and the dark. And I think what we see in so much in the Disney version of Peter Pan is we only see the light side. Yes. We don't really get to see the dark side. And I think we see more of the dark side in the 2003 version.
The 2003 version. Absolutely. And that's the thing. And that's because of the character that plays that role. But also I think we need to acknowledge that it's playing to a very different audience. The Disney one is probably playing to young children, kids, you know, and their parents kind of watching
it. In the 50s.
Do you I think films it would have played for adults as well.
I think the adults kind of supervising, but definitely it would have been aimed at a young, you know, kids, or, you know, kids that are still reading fairy tales in bed.
Yeah. Well, there's definitely one joke in the 1953 version of Disneyland where the crocodile's coming up to the boat, and Smee, who is Captain Hook's offsider, sort of says to the crocodile, says, "Ha, you know what, there's no more handouts today for you." The joke.
I love that was the joke you picked up.
The joke is, that was the in joke, because, of course, you know, the crocodile ate his first hand, and he was coming around, hunting around for another meal, and he was saying, "No more handouts for you today."
We are celebrating
pretty funny
Peter Pan and some of the less funny jokes in some of the films.
Oh, that's harsh.
Look, more coming up on Peter Pan right after this. We are speaking with Alison Cavey, who is the author of A Second Star to the Right, Peter Pan in the Popular Imagination. We're speaking with Alison about gender and sexuality in Peter Pan right after this.
Life is a wonderful life, a roving over the sea. Give me a career as a buccaneer, it's the life of a pirate for me. Oh, the life of a pirate for me. Oh, pirate's life is a wonderful life, they never bury your bones. For when it's all over, a jolly sea rover drops in on his friend Davy Jones. Oh, his very good friend Davy Jones.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9. That was It's a Pirate Life for Me from Disney's 1953 Peter Pan, which certainly reinvented the Peter Pan mythology in the filmic tradition. I don't know what our music director would make of us playing that track, but the reason that we played that track is because it's such a good example of the world that Neverland is. Mm-hmm. And that world has time and time again been said to be a man's world.
Really? Really, a man's world. Is that because it's an adventure land for boys? Is that what you mean? That we have here, we have pirates, we have Indians, we have mermaids.
Well, they're called the Lost Boys.
And they're called the Lost Boys.
You kind of put a sign up at the door and don't enter.
It's very much a boyhood version of masculinity. Is that what you mean?
Well, I think Peter Pan, the story, kind of really grapples with masculinity in a lot of ways and doesn't have very much to say about femininity.
Except as a betrayal of a mother, just correct. Replacing one child with another.
It truncates femininity in this kind of way and gives us a really kind of limited vision of femininity and womanhood. And as our guest Alison Cavey has pointed out, as a woman watching these films, you know, what are your expectations for your future life?
Well, that's the thing. I never connected with Peter Pan. You know the story, but you certainly don't feel like, you know, and some child, like I felt, you know, connected to Snow White or Cinderella, my goodness, no, but you don't even see yourself in this world. Mm-hmm. And to see yourself in Peter Pan is a damsel or a, you know,
that's
just
right,
a throwaway character.
A damsel in distress and a mother figure. Yourself.
Yeah.
You know.
There was no way as a female to connect to it.
No, and I would say that's very much the 1953 version. But when you fast forward 50 years to the 2003 version, all of a sudden the role of Wendy has changed. In the 2003 version, you know, Wendy doesn't really participate in the boys' games. She doesn't pick up a sword. She doesn't fight. Whereas in the 2003 version, you've actually got Wendy sticking up for herself and actually fighting and actually taking some of that active role. So, you know, there is an advance in that sense. But, Daniel, I sense a certain frown of disapproval coming my way.
Look, I love this story. I love the Peter Pan mythology and I love the characters in the story. I think there's something very charming about the relationship between Peter and Wendy. But, like, this is heterosexuality at its worst. Come on. The best that Wendy can aspire to be is the woman behind the man. The best that she can aspire to be, even if she does manage to pick up the sword in the 2003 version for a whole 15 seconds, is a mother who has one kiss in the corner of her mouth like her own mother.
Yeah, the hidden kiss.
Yeah, for a man. And then she kind of lives her life just thinking about Peter Pan, so much so that she's happy to give up her own daughter to Peter Pan when he comes back however many years later. Mm. I mean, it's a really kind of tragic portrayal of femininity and womanhood. And I think that's all the more present in the play. And I think the films have tempered that. Yes, they've given us this vision of truncated femininity, but the play, especially the final scene, which I haven't actually seen represented in film, is really quite heartbreaking. Peter Pan comes back. Wendy's older. She has to use a broom to fly. She can barely see him. She's big. He kind of looks at her with disgust. And it's quite tragic. We did sit down with Alison Cavey and have a chat about gender in Peter Pan. And we started by talking about Hook and about the kind of struggle over masculinity that is present in his person.
For me, Hook is struggling through the class system of range of English masculinity. There are many allusions in the novel to how he was very wealthy as a child. He's an aristocratic son. He went to Eton.
Yes.
And he is said to look like the Stuarts. So he has a touch. He's a little bit too much, right? He's a little bit too Catholic. He's a little bit too beautiful. And certainly when Barry was writing, that reference would have carried an allusion to opulence and indulgence. And so Hook is beautiful and he's wealthy. And at the same time, he's living on a ship. You know, these are working class seamen. They are roughly masculine. So you see this contrast between elite, effete English masculinity and very rough and tough working class laborers.
Of course, the other really interesting thing as well is that Hook is this, at least traditionally conceived, this kind of inverse father figure. He is the corollary to Mr. Darling.
Yes, and Barry made that stage direction from the beginning. And I don't think he was just trying to save money on actors. Yes, I mean, imagine a father who chooses to escape, or a father who has been sentenced. I wonder sometimes if Hook has not been placed there rather than chosen to be there. Because if he chose to be there, why would he have? He would have had to die as an adult to go to Neverland. Unless Neverland is only in Peter's head, and Barry says it is not. He said Neverland exists in all children's minds.
I'll do anything you say.
Well, all right. If you say you're a codfish.
I'm a codfish.
Louder.
I'm a codfish!
Hooray! Hook is a codfish, a codfish, a codfish, Hook is a codfish.
All right, Hook. You're free to go and never return.
It feels like it's this kind of great wrestling, doesn't it? This Peter Pan, the story is this kind of great wrestling with our role in the world and who we're supposed to be and what we're supposed to be and what happens if we don't accept that role. And in that way, it really is a brave text.
It is very brave. It's very brave for men. It offers a lot of possibilities for male readers and viewers. For women, the possibilities are many fewer unless you read yourself into the male characters.
Now, that's really interesting.
The only options for women are to be mothers.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I know that this is something that you've written about before. And I think that you've written, correct me if I'm wrong, that it is Mrs. Darling who offers women the kind of greatest possibility in this story.
She does, but it's a very limited possibility. The only possibility that she offers is the ability to withhold your heart for one person so that kiss in the corner of her mouth is always reserved for Peter. But Wendy and then Wendy's daughter spend their entire lives waiting for him to come get them, to go out to Neverland and then do his spring cleaning and have adventures. It's as though they cannot have adventures on their own. They have to have Peter come and get them. And so if I had 10 minutes with James Barry, I would say, so Neverland exists in all children's minds, but all women can, all girl children can imagine is spring cleaning.
Right.
And being a mother. I think obviously the early 20th century was a very different place.
Yes.
But I think he did not understand the female imagination at all.
But what makes that even more tragic is the end of the play. The play ends, and this, for some reason, has never been represented in film, certainly not in Disney, certainly not in the more recent incarnations. But Peter comes back, and Wendy has grown older, and she cannot see him. And in fact, she needs a broom to fly.
She says, I've grown too big to fly. And it's this heart-wrenching moment. I said, oh, Peter, I can't wear that anymore. He hands up the dress that she had worn as a child. She said, I can't wear that anymore. I've grown too big. Don't look at me.
Yes.
And again, for feminist studies, that's a huge moment, right? Because the female body is both objectified and already too large. It took up too much space. The grown female body has no space at all in this novel. It's quite literally hideous.
It's heartbreaking. I remember reading that last chapter and just finding it so crushing.
Absolutely. She has no meaning anymore. And then he takes her daughter. She gives up her daughter.
Jeez.
And the daughter, Moira, comes back and says, oh, I've had the most wonderful adventures. And of course, she can barely remember her own adventures, but she lets this strange boy take her child.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9. That was part one of our chat with Alison Cavey on gender in Peter Pan. And, of course, the soundtrack there from Finding Neverland, which is actually an Academy Award-winning soundtrack. Finding Neverland was nominated for 7, I think, Academy Awards, including Best Picture. And this, I think, was its only win.
That's right. Jan A.P. Kaczmarek.
Very well pronounced.
Well done.
Points to you.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of what Alison has to say is really, really interesting. Mm. To think about the way that this much-loved, timeless story deals with gender in a very time-specific way.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, you know, as I was saying, this is a film, as a child, I'd never connected with. And I loved adventure stories, even as I was growing, you know, those kind of Goonies stories, those kind of... And this one, you know, there was no character for me to be able to relate to at all in this story. And obviously the representations that I was seeing of women were just nothing that appealed to me.
I'd like to flip that on its head. I mean, just as there's really no real future projection, you know, other alternatives for female representation, I mean, what is there for the male representation here? What is it for boys in this beyond childhood? You know, moving beyond childhood, at least for women in this, you actually get to, there's the idea that they will become on, they will get to grow up and become mothers and actually start to, and have an adult life.
And if I
there's none at all here for boys.
If I can flip that
there's
on
none.
Its head as well.
Please.
I think what this film, or this indeed the story is really about, is about taking these roles that we are given at birth and choosing to accept or deny them. I mean, what does Peter Pan do if not reject the role that he was assigned? He hears his parents speaking about who he is to be and he runs away. Mm. And there's a real escapism in that the film and the mythology and the play and the books, they celebrate. Mm. So I think it's very queer in that way. I mean, there are consequences, yes, mm-hmm. for shunning your birth-given role. And yes, it's the women in the story who more readily accept their birth-given role. And that is, I think, why it is the father figure here, played by Jason Isaacs in 2003, I think, so well, which mm-hmm. is so interesting because here we have in the one character, because, of course, it's the one actor, we have the acceptance of the role that you're given at birth, the father, the breadwinner, and the complete rejection of it, this kind of Eton graduate who roams about in Neverland, loses his hand to a crocodile and chases a who-knows-how-old boy. Mm. I mean, so there's this real kind of contradiction between what happens if we accept the role we are given and what happens if we reject it.
He's actually quite effeminate and incompetent. Represent, you know, Mr. Darling, you see him, he's socially incompetent, socially awkward. Correct. You know, he's not successful. He's not really fulfilling that aim of masculinity to be an alpha. He's not. And then you see him going to Neverland where he's the absolute reverse.
Well, he's still incompetent as Hook.
Hook is still incompetent,
isn't he? I mean, this story is an indictment on adulthood, really.
True.
But look, there's so much in it. We've just kind of scraped the surface of gender in Peter Pan. And right after this, we're looking at sexuality in Peter Pan. So more on Outtakes right after this.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we are celebrating Peter Pan. This week, of course, is J.M. Barrie's birthday. He would have been, I think, 158. what better an opportunity than this to celebrate the story and the filmic legacy that it has given rise to. Now, we've looked a little bit at gender this evening, and we've been speaking with Alison Cavey about the way that the filmic tradition has captured gender in Peter Pan. And we also had a chat with Alison about how the filmic tradition has dealt with sexuality in this story. We've talked a bit about gender, but I do want to come to sexuality in Peter Pan. You write that desire is both everywhere and nowhere in Peter Pan.
And I think that's right. Desire can be for a lot of things. I think there is very little sexual desire in the story. I think it has been put onto the story, both because it's a soft heterosexual love story for children, which sells pretty well, and particularly, I think, in the Hogan, is exaggerated beyond the very innocent exchange of the acorn, which saves Wendy's life and is called a kiss. But I think that Barry was writing very lightly, but very carefully when he made it a kiss that saved Wendy's life. And it's heterosexuality that does save her, and it's her role as a mother that gives her purpose. The end point of desire has already been arrived at for Wendy. She is already a mother. She's already satisfied in her role. She seems to want nothing else. Whereas Peter is a sort of gaping hole of want. He wants to grow up, but he can't. He wants to kill Hook, but he can't. He wants to go home, but he won't. There are so many moments where his desire governs his behavior.
But yet the point has been made that the sexual focus of the story has changed throughout time, and that instead of being focused on the tension, as it were, between Peter and Wendy, the sexual focus has now shifted to the tension between Hook and Pan.
Yeah, I think you've articulated that so well. So in the book that I edited, David Munns and I worked on a chapter on queer sexuality and the appeal of Peter Pan to gay men in film and television. And so I think it's a really important line that has been brought out increasingly in the 20th century articulations of the story. So if you look at the British and then American television series Queer as Folk, that television series features a very beautiful, naive but ego-driven young man, and a much older, also incredibly beautiful, very wealthy and successful man who is sort of the king of the club scene in Pittsburgh. Mm. And the relationship between the two of them is really a contest of will, but it's also an extreme exhibition of physical prowess. So the physicality of these two characters and the sexuality is apparent. There is absolutely no moment in Queer as Folk where that sexuality doesn't drive the entire narrative. But the articulation of self through that sexuality, I think, does give us a lens back into Peter Pan, which is to say, what if Hook had been as openly desiring as Brian in the story, in Queer as Folk? And what if Pan had been willing to be desiring himself? And also desired. He would never accept desire in the narrative, but what if in Queer as Folk he does? And it becomes this incredibly powerful relationship in which both are nearly destroyed, much as they are in Peter and Wendy, where Hook himself, of course, dies. He succumbs to time. And since Queer as Folk was written and acted during a time when AIDS, HIV/AIDS was continuing to rise in the gay community in the United States, the narrative of being HIV positive and risking your life for desire and for beauty is a very strong one. And certainly when the younger character in that story chooses to have sex without condoms, the older character says, you cannot do that.
This kind of great line, to die would be an awfully big adventure, takes on even greater resonance, really, in a reading like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's that youthful willingness to risk your life because you don't know that it can end. It's interesting that when Justin, the Peter character in Queer as Folk, chooses to do that, he's an artist and he's been horribly injured in a queer attack. He can't draw. He says, I'm just a cripple. What am I worth now? I might as well just basically go kill myself. And Brian says, well, just find a way for you to do your art differently. And he finds in the computer program that will allow him to draw again. And it's that redirecting of youthful passion that I think is missing in Peter and Wendy. The original story allows that youthful desire to drive the entire story. It's the death drive writ large, and it's both to deliver death and also to die. It's just Peter can't die. He always has to be on that island.
The other thing that kind of lends itself to the gay psyche is the kind of freedom that you write about, which is this kind of freedom from fear, freedom from want, freedom from age, which Peter Pan is consonant with and which has really resonated, and maybe why Peter Pan is now an epithet for a gay man.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for that desire to be eternally young and eternally beautiful, and how it has come to, I think, in many ways, be a popular reference to gay men, but to undersell the reality of being an adult gay man. I think popular culture has deprived gay men of the right to be adults. Of course, everybody wants to be beautiful and everybody wants to be young forever. But gay men are adults in the world and they are not just the subject of their own desires.
I do just want to ask, in terms of the kind of sexuality that has been read onto Peter Pan, how do you feel about readings which posit childhood as this kind of essentially queer sphere? So a story like Peter Pan is kind of lending itself to kind of endless queer possibility.
Yeah, I mean, I studied with Ellis Hansen when I was in university. Yeah, he's a professor at Cornell. And okay. He actually wrote a book called Outtakes on queer film. And when I,
oh, really?
Yeah. So all those many years ago, he had us read Alice in Wonderland. And I said, I think we should be reading Peter Pan. And he said, oh, everybody's read Peter Pan. What do you think? You're the first person to think children are queer? And so, again, all these years later, we actually had this conversation, I think, about a year ago. I said, you know, look, I've written on Peter Pan. I can't really stop thinking about it. I don't think it's over yet. He said, it's the richest text to support this idea that childhood is alien and dangerous and eroticized and always outside the reach.
But Peter, how do we get to Neverland?
Fly, of course.
Fly?
It's easy. Now, think of the happiest things. It's the same as having wings.
Let's all try it just once more.
Look, we're rising off the floor.
To my knee.
Oh, my. We can fly.
You can fly.
We can fly.
Well, that was Alison Cavey talking about sexuality in Peter Pan. Alison is, of course, the author of Second Star to the Right, Peter Pan in the Popular Imagination. And, you know,
interesting comparison to Queer as Folk. It kind of made us go, you, in the studio and start.
Don't buy it.
No.
Don't buy it. Don't buy it at all.
I mean, when I read it, because Alison has written about this kind of comparison, I wasn't quite there. But hearing her talk about it, I think, you know, she's not saying they're one and the same, but that they furnish a really interesting comparison and that the kind of relationship kind of illuminates the relationship between Hook and Pan.
Well, look, I would say it's an interesting lens to illuminate this story, but it's the wrong lens. And because I think what this is it's actually a fear of sexuality that's driving this book, because in many ways J.M. Barrie was believed to be asexual. And I think, you know, his childhood was such a glory time for him, and he wanted to relive it. Hence his relationship with these boys, and hence rewriting this, writing, you know, the series of Peter Pan. And the fact is that, you know, if you're a very small, slightly built man who's asexual, moving into the adult sexualized world, you're kind of left apart. You know, there's something missing from you.
Well, he was married more than once.
He was only married once.
Never consummated, apparently.
Never consummated, no.
Twice.
No, that was wrong. I verified that fact. That was incorrect in that article.
Oh, really?
Did a fact check. And he never consummated his... He never consummated his marriage. And I think, you know, I feel that what you'll see
the two marriage fact is incorrect, but somehow reporters know about how or whether or not he consummated his marriage.
Well, I think
one
of the boys, you know, one of the boys, oh, he one talked, of the Llewellyn boys okay. also
he talked
mentioned
about the boys
that he was
who
innocent.
He did not have a sexual relationship with about his sexual life with his wife.
No, I'm not saying that. No, yeah. No. No, this is still a lawyer coming out in you, Daniel.
There is clearly
there's a lot of myth, a lot of sexuality here.
And the question for me is you know, how much of this mythology do we read on to Peter Pan and read Peter Pan and watch Peter Pan in light of? And how separate should the story of J.M. Barrie and his life, so this kind of Finding Neverland world, be from the kind of Peter Pan world that Disney gives us and Mark Forster gives us?
You know what? I think in the last year or 2 years, our our world has changed in how we want to be seeing these stories and the authors that tell these stories. And I think it now matters more than it ever has. People are interested. People want to know this sort of stuff in all the stuff that's kind of arisen from Hollywood.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
this stuff does matter. And, you know, that's why there is intrigue and people digging, literally spending, you know, years digging into the history of this author to, and, you know, one calling him asexual, others people are suggesting he was, you know, inappropriate, quite sinister in predatory behaviour.
I love that we have
both
of these arguments being run at the same
digging
time.
For dirt. Digging for
right
dirt.
Right in the last minute of our outtakes. Mm. But, yeah, I think it's changed. I think our lens has now changed in how we are looking back at these stories.
And, indeed, I'm sure that the story of Peter Pan will continue to evolve and change with these lenses. That is all that we have time for this evening. It's been great jumping back into the studio after a month off. There's so much more that we could talk about. So stay tuned. More on Joy right after this.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.